For auto racing enthusiasts, few movies have captured the speed and danger of the sport better than the 1971 film Le Mans. The film was a long gestating obsession for its star, Steve McQueen, and a new book chronicles the making of what would become a notorious box office failure. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. A recently released book chronicles the making of the 1971 film Le Mans, and I'm happy to have on the program today Don Nunley, property master on the film and author with Marshall Terrell of the book Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Charles.
Thanks for joining us, and congratulations on the book. It's a fascinating read with lots of amazing behind-the-scenes pictures, but I wanted to set the stage. This is, of course, a film about a very legendary race, a 24-hour endurance auto race in France. The film is legendary for problems in its making and for the point in Steve McQueen's career where he was coming off just an extraordinary run of successes in the 60s. How did you get involved with this production?
Well, Charles, I was working for a company called Cinema Center Films, a CBS company at the time, and I just finished a film for them called Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman and directed by Arthur Penn. They were happy with my work, and one day I was walking across the set wondering what I was going to do next, and the head of production, Bob Rosen, saw me and came over and said, "Don, we are interested in having you do our next film. Would you be interested in doing the film with Steve McQueen, 24-Hour Le Mans?" And I said, "Would I be interested? Are you kidding?" Of course. I mean, he was the biggest star in Hollywood at the time, and I was just 30 years old, so I didn't have 40 films under my belt at that time. And I was thrilled. But I did say to Bob, I know nothing about racing. And his comment to me was, right on. He said, "You'll learn."
What a way to learn, too. It was quite the crucible. Exactly. All location shoot over in France, so everyone decamped to France. And, of course, you're working outside most of the time with very fast cars. I think some of these cars go over 230 miles an hour. Did you ever feel like this was a dangerous shoot?
Oh, every shot was dangerous. You know, Steve was a notoriously good race driver. He had just raced in Sebring and had come in second place behind Mario Andretti. So he had his chops, and he was working with the best drivers in the world, and he had the best cars in the world. The idea of the film was that we would shoot most of it during the actual race itself. We had 27 Panavision cameras, including three mounted on our own 908 Porsche.
My goodness.
But the problem was, when the studio picked up the picture from Warner Brothers, who had somehow dropped it, they must have had a crystal ball. But Cinema Center thought they'd died and gone to heaven. They had Steve McQueen in a racing picture after Bullet. You know, they thought this is a no-brainer. And so they took off on the picture without a script. They hired John Sturges, who had worked with Steve on other pictures and actually made Steve probably the movie star he was.
Sure, Magnificent Seven.
Magnificent Seven. But John and Steve never got together on a script. They argued and they tried and they worked. And we had a deadline. We had a race to shoot in June. And that was the wheels up and away you go, because they had to shoot the race. So because we didn't get all the footage we expected to get during the actual race, mainly because the star refused to do a few things. He wouldn't put on his pilot suit and walk on the apron before the race.
In front of crowds.
50,000 people, which would have been great footage. So we had to recreate a lot of things.
That was an interesting episode in your book. I wanted to touch on that, sort of an insight into McQueen. He was fuming, I guess, because the studio forbade him from actually participating in the Le Mans race?
That's correct, because the whole picture hinged on Steve. If he got hurt, the budget of the picture was shot. I mean, we were over. And they put a premium. They said, "You can drive, but the premium on your life for the 24 hours is $3.5 million. The studio kind of balked at that. Anyhow, Steve was upset because he couldn't drive, so he didn't cooperate with us during the actual race, where we could have picked up some amazing shots. And because of that, it fell on me to recreate a lot of things we weren't intending to recreate, like the paddock area where all the support trucks are. We have 50 vehicles out there, tire trucks, all the tents where all the people set up for the VIPs, the headlight companies, you name it, they were all there. And we had to recreate that whole thing, which was not easy because all the vehicles that were at the actual race had already left for other races. And they had scheduled, so we had to beg and borrow and steal to do that. Anyhow, we started out to shoot the picture totally in 6 weeks, and I was there over 7 months.
Amazing. And throughout it all, a revolving door of screenwriters. John Sturgis, the great director, literally just goes home after a month or 6 weeks of filming and doesn't come back. So you have
That's correct.
Switch directors midstream. And I gather McQueen was in an interesting place at this point. Even though this had been a pet project of his and something near and dear to his heart for so many years, the pendulum was swinging back and forth in his life on and off screen, and he was acting out in strange ways. Had you ever been on a production quite like this?
I don't know if there's ever been a production quite like this. I certainly had. I was just turned 31 on the movie, so I was pretty young, and I didn't have a great resume at the time. So I was learning as I went. But I do know Steve was under a tremendous amount of pressure. First of all, the film, because Sturgis left, the studio took over, he lost control. He was going through a very rough time with his marriage, which ended up divorcing shortly after the film. He found out he was on the Charles Manson hit list. It was just, you know, one thing after another, tremendous pressure. And the fact that his project that he nursed for 10 years was in trouble, it is no wonder. It's actually amazing we finished the film. The nice thing about writing this book is I think it gives people an insight into three things: a picture behind the scenes of making a movie, a great insight into Steve's life at the time, and these amazing cars and drivers we were working with. I shot hundreds of photographs, which 260 of my photographs are in the book. Nice to see them come alive again after being stored in my closet for 46 years.
Yeah, in addition to being property master, I gather that at some point the set photographer gave you some cameras and a lot of film, and you sort of became an assistant set photographer as well.
Well, I always have my own concerns in shooting stills. I don't necessarily try to pick up the stuff they'll use in publicity. I have to match everything in the picture from day to day. When we're shooting a film that literally takes place within a 24-hour time frame, but we shoot it over 7 months, whatever hour of the race we're shooting that particular day, the cars have to match. We start the picture with 55 cars in the actual race, and 17 finished. And we had rain, we had all kinds of, you know, had wrecks. So the cars each hour change dramatically. And for me, the big task was each night I'd find out what they planned to shoot the next day, which hour of the race. And I'd have to take those cars back to our stable of cars and repaint, retouch, refix them up if they're at the beginning of the race, how they look halfway through the race. And that was a big problem because we had 27 cameras film the actual race, so we were matching a lot of footage we had with close-ups and, you know, other shots.
So so a lot of these photographs in the book are your behind-the-scenes sort of continuity record for yourself?
That, and then I shot a lot of crew, and I shot a lot of Steve, and I shot a lot of stuff just because I had the cameras around my neck all the time. And it was nice because working with Mel Traxel, the still photographer, he would get the stuff processed really quick. You know, we're shooting 35 millimeter back there, not digital, so everything had to be sent out and we got it back overnight. And I'd get prints and I'd get my slides. It was just fortunate that Mel and I had such a good relationship. But many times, still photographers don't want you to do that. That's their job. But he was very open and let me shoot what I wanted to shoot and worked with me closely.
I was fascinated to read that obviously you shot a lot of footage during the actual Le Mans race, the professional race, and that they allowed you to mount cameras on a car in that race with the other racers. And that car did quite well.
It did. First, this is long before digital, long before GoPros. So the smallest 35 millimeter cameras were made by Aeroflex. And they still were good sized. I mean, you know, you don't think of one with holding the palm of your hand. It would take two hands and a strong man to pick them up. We got permission. We took our 908 Porsche that the company had bought over to England. And our key grip, Galen Schultz, mounted three cameras on this 908, one forward and two aft. and then we built cowlings to camouflage them, to basically hide them. It then had to qualify, and it never happened before. They'd never allowed a car in Le Mans with actual cameras on it for safety reasons. But these were done so well that they qualified the car. The car would come in for pit stops to change cameras, not film. They were quick mounts, and when we come in for a pit stop, like changing a tire, they'd pop the cameras off, put new cameras on, all set to go. The driver actually had a trigger on the steering wheel. He could start the forward camera or the aft cameras anytime he chose, but they only had about 8 minutes worth of film. So we had to come in quite often to change cameras. We ended up actually finishing the race, one of the 17 cars that finished the race. And we were, I believe it was second or third in our class.
Amazing.
Which is pretty amazing.
Even with the extra weight of the cameras and film.
And the time for stopping that many, you know, we had many more pit stops than most cars.
Certainly, this is a film about an endurance race, and the film itself, the making of it, was an endurance race. You had worked with McQueen, actually, almost a decade before, or more than a decade before, in television. Is that right?
Well, when I first got in the business, I worked on some sets. I wouldn't say I worked with McQueen. I worked on his show, Wanted Dead or Alive.
Very popular late 50s TV show.
Yeah, he was just coming up, and I was barely starting. So I'd say we met each other on the set, but it wasn't anything formal, and it wasn't like I was there for a long time. I was working on The Rifleman and Tales of the Plainsman and other films, other TV series for 4-Star at the time. So I met Steve, and little did I know, or he know, that 10 years later we'd be working intimately one of the biggest films of his life.
Did he change? Had he changed in that intervening decade for you, just watching him work and not the star Steve McQueen, but the man Steve McQueen?
Well, when you become a megastar like Steve did, and Steve always had the persona around him that he was going to be a big star. He acted like a really big star when he did Wanted Dead or Alive. It was very particular. He was hard to work with for directors because he wanted to do it his way. So Steve had this aura about him, and he was a star at the time. But when he got to Le Mans, he was the number one box office star in the world. And with that comes a lot of, he had his entourage around him. He had his friends. And he basically called the shots when he started the movie. It was all his game. And he had reached what he had hoped to reach. Unfortunately, this film took him down a few pegs and basically almost ruined him. He found out he had a huge IRS bill at the time. So it broke him for a while. I think he became more humble after Le Mans.
And he was personally invested in this. It was his own production company that was partially funding the program, and it just put his whole business empire and his personal finances at complete risk, as I understand it.
Right. He lost everything to the studio, for the studio to finish the film. They laid the law down. They took away his points. They took away his salary. They said, you know, you'll get a far end. If this picture is greatly successful, you'll make a little money. But since it was his pet project and his name was all over it and everybody in Hollywood knew it was being made, he knew he had to finish the picture.
There's a story late in the book after a lot of harrowing escapades during the making of the film and the general danger that was on the set every day just with filming these cars and racers moving so fast with McQueen in a car. But I was astonished that there's a story you tell towards the end of the book about one night where apparently he almost killed himself and a co-star in a car wreck that he had kept quiet for quite some time.
That's true. He had a chateau about 30 minutes from the set that he stayed in. He had taken the co-star, Louise Edlin was her name, who, by the way, became a member of parliament in Sweden later on, as a footnote. And Louise was a beautiful girl, a really nice gal. And they'd been partying out at his chateau, and about 2 in the morning or sometime late in the morning, or late night, he decided to drive her back to her hotel. And he'd been using a few drugs, drinking. I don't think he drank a lot, mostly drugs. But he wasn't in any shape to drive. But he insisted on driving, and he was driving a Peugeot, one of the company-loaned cars. And they went into a ditch, and he threw her right through the windshield. It was a major crash. Everybody thought that she was dead for a few minutes, and they kind of stood there, and it was raining. And finally, she stirred, and They got her up, and luckily she was not hurt at all, had a few bruises. I don't think she was a big fan of Steve's after that, but they kept it very quiet. His agent got involved, and you know how they can do things. They bury stuff they don't want people to know about, and nobody said anything about it on the whole picture. Nobody knew anything about it.
Amazing. And the next day went right back to work.
Yeah, they were there. And I think she had, like I said, a few bruises on her that were unexplained, but I think she was beautiful enough to get away with it.
It's been, well, the film was made in 1970, released in 1971. It's been more than 46 years since you worked on this. In hindsight, in the rearview mirror, as your title suggests, do you appreciate the adventure?
Oh, you know what? Every film I did, I appreciate, because it was all a learning experience. It was an exciting job. It was a lot of work, a lot of hours. And I look at a film, whether it's successful at the box office or not, whether I'm proud of what I did on that film. And I think the film has proven to be made properly. People appreciate what we did with the cars. It's way before digital, way before CGI. Everything you see in it is real. Steve actually drove the cars at over 200 miles an hour on the set. So the stuff you see now is something I look at and go, well, I think I did my job well. And I think the people put a film together that's going to last forever.
And in hindsight, I think people do enjoy that film quite a bit. And it does capture the spirit of the race, which I guess in the end was exactly what McQueen was going for. So you all did.
And he'd be happy today, I think.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for telling stories about the making of this legendary film. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity to do it, and I hope people will buy the book and enjoy it and let us know what they think about it.
I've been discussing the recently published book, Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror, with Don Nunley, co-author with Marshall Terrell, of a behind-the-scenes memoir of the 1971 film Le Mans and the struggle to bring Steve McQueen's pet project to the big screen. A cautionary tale of ego, speed, and obsession both on and off screen, the book is also a pictorial history of the making of the film. Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror is published by Dalton Watson Fine Books and available for order from most major booksellers. For an expanded version of this interview, log on to ktep.org. Thanks to Kim Garcia for recording today's show. On Film's engineer is Evan Walsh. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.